loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we discussed John Bolton's trip to the Middle East and what it means about Donald Trump's promise to pull thousands of U.S. troops out of Syria within 4 months. Is this withdrawal going to happen or will it be blocked? And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, a second pro-democratic false flag operation has been revealed in Alabama. The New York Times reported today that progressive activists set up a fake social media page that appeared to come from Alabama evangelicals, falsely representing that Republican Roy Moore would make Alabama dry. The single state operation cost another $100,000 over 2 weeks. That's the amount that the Internet Research Agency spent nationwide in the 2016 election. Meanwhile, the sonic attacks, so-called sonic attacks in Cuba, that were supposed to be from Russia, have now been attributed to very loud crickets. Next, four Republican senators led by Marco Rubio of Florida last week sponsored a bill that would seek to criminalize the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, or BDS movement. It would also impose harsh sanctions on Syria and increase military aid to Israel and Egypt. The bill has broad bipartisan support in the Senate and will be called to an expedited vote as early as today. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Elliot Engel, a Democrat, said that he will seek to push the bill through the House. Then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Today we talk about the Los Angeles teachers who plan to strike on Thursday. And then today we enter day 17 of the partial government shutdown, already the second longest in American history. President Trump is threatening to upend negotiations with Congress by declaring a national emergency that would allow him to build his border wall while completely bypassing Congress. Negotiations between Republicans and Democrats over the weekend did not yield any results. And finally, Jim Bridenstine, the NASA administrator, was forced to rescind an invitation to the head of the Russian space agency to visit the United States after the offer was criticized by key senators. Space historically has been a point on which the U.S. and Russia have cooperated, but is this cancellation yet another sign of a dangerous arms race leading to the militarization of space? And in other headlines, Cyntoia Brown was granted clemency today by Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam, which means that she will be released on August 7th and will be on parole for 10 years after serving 15 years in prison. She was sentenced at the age of 16 to life with the possibility of parole after 51 years when she would be 67 years old. She was a sex trafficking victim as a minor, and she shot a 45-year-old man who she was prostituted to because she believed that he had a weapon and he intended to kill her. After much publicity on the case, the Tennessee Supreme Court ruled last month that she had to remain in prison for 51 years, but her supporters continued to advocate for her release. Jim Yong Kim has stepped down as the head of the World Bank and will go into the private sector as part of a firm working on infrastructure development. Kim became president of the bank in 2012. According to an informal post-war understanding, the International Monetary Fund is always led by a European, and the World Bank is always led by an American. For the first time, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has missed oral arguments before the court. Last month, Ginsburg had surgery to remove cancerous nodules from her lung. Her illness has raised the possibility that President Trump may get to nominate yet another Supreme Court justice. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Syria and the question of whether U.S. troops are indeed leaving Syria. National Security Advisor John Bolton backpedaled on President Trump's promise to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, saying during a visit to Israel yesterday that the withdrawal would take place only when ISIS was completely destroyed. Then Bolton traveled to Turkey today to seek assurances from Ankara that in the event of a U.S. withdrawal from Syria, that the Kurds in Syria would be safe from an attack from the Turkish military. We're joined from San Francisco by Rick Sterling. He is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. And we're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. Rick and Mark, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Good to be here.
Brian, John, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you both for joining us. This is a big issue. I mean, it was very clear that Donald Trump wanted to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. I mean, it wasn't just a feint. I mean, the day after he did it, this day after he announced it, we had James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, announce his resignation. The resignation letter doesn't talk specifically about Syria. It talks about other things. But the timing, you know, was not coincidental. Again, in Washington, among Democrats, among Republicans within the military-industrial complex, it appears that Donald Trump might be one, the only one within the establishment who actually favors the U.S. withdrawal from Syria. And now you have his national security advisor saying, not so fast. We're not going to leave until ISIS is completely defeated, et cetera, et cetera. Rick Sterling, are U.S. troops leaving Syria or not leaving Syria?
They are not leaving Syria right now, and the promise for them to leave is getting walked back as you, and it gets vaguer and vaguer. First it was 30 days, then it was 4 months, and now with these new conditions that Bolton has put on it, it looks increasing like it's never going to happen if Bolton and company have their way.
Mark Sloboda, same question. Are U.S. troops leaving Syria?
No, they're not leaving Syria, not now, not in the foreseeable future. The conditions that President Bolton, I mean, National Security Advisor...
Wait a second, was that a joke? Were you joking?
Yes, that was a joke.
Okay, good.
The conditions that Bolton has set are designed specifically, of course, to prevent any U.S. Troop withdrawal from Syria. He set conditions that involve the complete defeat of ISIS, which, of course, ISIS is in Syria, and as it is in other countries around the world, not because of Bashar al-Assad. ISIS isn't in Libya because of Bashar al-Assad, and it's not in Afghanistan because of Bashar al-Assad or in Yemen. It's in these places because of power vacuums created by U.S. meddling and interventions and those of its allies in these countries. So the idea that you could ever completely defeat ISIS while large swaths of Syrian territory are no man's land outside of any government control, of course, means that ISIS will never be defeated. Likewise, he made assurance, promises that the true U.S. troops wouldn't be withdrawn until they can get the Erdogan regime in Turkey to agree not to attack the Kurdish YPG, which represents the majority of the U.S.-backed so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. Of course, Turkey's primary aim in Syria is not to combat ISIS, never has been. They're not even interested in fighting on ISIS, but to destroy the YPG, in broader terms and far more than likely ethnic cleansing northern Syria of Kurds and total. So setting a condition that you don't withdraw until you can get Erdogan to promise not to attack the YPG is absurd. It's not going to happen. Erdogan's not going to agree to that. And what Erdogan has actually asked for is that the U.S. assist its military invasion and occupation of East Syria, you know, kind of a tag team to take the U.S. place, but they want extensive U.S. air support and logistics that might actually mean that the U.S. has to put more troops in Syria if they were to agree to Turkey's demands. And the third condition is another question until Israel's security is assured. Well, I mean, that, of course, is a ridiculous statement, and Israel continues to occupy Syria's Golan Heights and has backed jihadist rebels in the country and is continually making airstrikes against Syria. So these conditions are designed to ensure that the U.S. never pulls out of Syria. And Bolton and Pompeo and Lindsey Graham have been on the full court press to basically reassert neocon control of the Trump administration. And it seems that Trump is already waffling and giving in to them.
Mark Sloboda, John Bolton made a comment yesterday that he is going to talk to the Turkish government about ensuring the rights and the safety, more importantly, of Syrian Kurds. The Turks responded in a way that guaranteed nothing for Bolton. President Erdogan said that the Turkish government fights only Kurdish terrorists. So where does that leave us with the YPG?
Yeah, well, of course, the Turkish government considers the YPG to be terrorists, and the YPG is the military formation of Syrian Kurds. Most other countries do not consider the YPG to be terrorists. Certainly the United States, which has been allied with them in Syria for the past few years, doesn't. This is coming from a government, Turkey, that has, been arming, training, and supplying, the 31 flavors of jihad, including al-Qaeda, and has had all sorts of documented coordination with al-Qaeda in Idlib, accusing someone else of supporting terrorists. It's kind of really Orwellian to have these words come out of the Turkish representative mouths. Basically, anything that any representative of the Turkish government says about Syria, you can pretty much be assured that the exact opposite is true.
Let's bring Rick Sterling back into the discussion. Rick, I want to have both Rick and Mark Sloboda speak to this issue, because what I want to try to understand is the dynamic within the Trump administration. Now, Trump, again, as I said in the beginning, Trump announced the troop withdrawal. It was considered a startling announcement. On December 26th, Trump said these words: 1 year ago, I gave our generals 6 more months in Syria. I said, go ahead, get them. And it turns out it was really a year and a half ago. I said, go get them. We need 6 months, they said. I said, go get them. Then they said, give us another 6 months. I said, go get them. Then they said, can we have one more, like another period of 6 months? I said, nope, nope. I said, I gave you a lot of 6 months. Now we're going to do it in a different way. Outside of the specific kind of language that's very peculiar to Donald Trump, aside from language and the way he presents, this is not simply a throwaway line. He's going into an explanation, his own explanation, of why he's announced that U.S. troops are leaving Syria. In other words, it's a serious position on the part of Trump. Now, John Bolton is the national security advisor. He serves at the pleasure of the president. It was Trump who brought him into the administration. He replaced General McMaster when McMaster resigned. John Bolton can be fired by Donald Trump. So if Donald Trump really wants to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, and I think it's quite clear from his explanation, however weirdly worded it is, that he actually did want to pull U.S. troops out of Syria, and he also wanted to pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. He compromised and said he would only pull out half. In response, Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, very popular at the Pentagon, resigned. Rick Sterling, this isn't, quote, the deep state. It's not some hidden conspiracy. John Bolton is Donald Trump's appointee. Help our audience understand the dynamics inside the Trump administration.
Well, it's chaotic, obviously. Trump is erratic. He's not very well educated, and he's used to a management style that comes from real estate and hotel where he can issue dictates and it'll be followed. Whereas in the government in Washington, you just can't issue it by tweet, come up with a dramatic change in policy without a lot of planning and discussions and so forth. So in one sense, it's a question of management style. In another sense, it shows the dysfunctional nature of it, because he's wanting to implement policies that are in contradiction to the policies favored by the very influential people he's appointed, such as Bolton and Pompeo and so forth. In addition to that, now he's in the latest, you know, chaotic situation there. Both Netanyahu and Erdogan are squeezing him and trying to milk the situation for everything they can. The latest is Netanyahu was telling Bolton that it's time for the U.S. to recognize the Golan Heights as being Israel, which, of course, would be a huge diplomatic change. But then the U.S. did agree to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and that was a momentous event in itself. Basically, we've got a dysfunctional, you know, government in Washington, and in the one sense, Trump is. Every now and then he wakes up in the middle of the night and he realizes he campaigned on a pledge of getting the U.S. out of Syria, getting the U.S. out of Afghanistan, and stopping the policy of the U.S. being the policeman of the world for various reasons. But he did campaign on that, and that was popular. That helped to get him elected. On the other hand, he's got such strong allegiances and alliance with neoconservatives, and he keeps appointing them into powerful positions of authority. So that's why we get these dramatic swings in statements and policies. And there's a lot of danger here. So you know, I think that's where we're at.
I want to basically ask the same question to Mark Sloboda, but preface it with this: there was some discussion here, Mark, before our show about what does Trump care about. And some people were making the point that Trump is surrounded by advisors who actually reflect the neoconservative consensus on things like the U.S. should never leave Syria, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, some people are arguing, well, it's only because Bolton is in Israel and talking to Benjamin Netanyahu, and it's Netanyahu's opinion that Trump really is impacted on. Again, I want to ask your opinion about what constitutes the real dynamic here. When we talked to Ambassador Peter Ford last week, and we were skeptical about whether U.S. troops would actually end up leaving Syria. Ambassador Ford felt that they would leave. And then Mike Pence had said again a day later, yes, we're committed to leaving. Is this a raging debate inside the Trump administration? Or just, again, what's the dynamic from your point of view?
Yeah, okay, first of all, it has to be remembered that it's not just Bolton, of course. This is basically the entire cabinet, Pompeo, not the least of which, Mattis supposedly resigned largely over all of this. But, you know, it's basically every other figure, not just in the cabinet, but across the government in total. I mean, it's Trump. I can count the number of political figures who have supported Trump's withdrawal on one hand. That might be Rand Paul, Elizabeth Warren, Ted Lieu, Congressman, and Tulsi Gabbard. That's about it. I can't think of anyone else who has voice support. And, you know, that includes the bureaucracies, you know, as well. And the entirety of the media was against it. And while it's technically true that Trump has the ability to fire Bolton, the reality is that Bolton was probably forced on Trump, Bolton and a number of other figures, and that Bolton and the neocons that he represents can fire Trump. Because the neocons at this point, we make a movie, The Revenge of the Neocons, they essentially not only have control of the administration at this point and the Republican Party that they originally came from, but at this point, the Democrats have completely aligned themselves with them. And this goes all the way back to Hillary Clinton's campaign when Robert Kagan, brought the neocons flocking to Hillary Clinton's banner. And even before, when Obama was hiring neocons like Kagan's wife, Victoria Nuland, to positions within his government. So this is longstanding. And the neocons have a lot of support in the Senate, and Lindsey Graham is not the least of those. And I am quite certain that they almost literally have a gun pointed to Trump's head with saying that if you don't give us what we want foreign policy-wise and keep appointing these people and keep them in office, then we can see the Democrats' impeachment proceedings against you come to fruition. And I think this is the political leverage that they use against Trump. And there's also a problem when talking about filling these positions. The neocon / humanitarian imperialist, on the liberal side of the coin, they're really the same thing, have so dominated U.S. foreign policy establishment, the schools that produce them, thinking for so long that there are very few figures with any credible experience and, you know, the proper training necessary to take these positions in government, like national security advisor, who don't come from this school of thinking of American exceptionalism and the belief that the United States should be the global, I don't like this, policeman is absurd, global military hegemon, you know, bestriding the world, using its forces without any regard for international law willy-nilly because they are above it. And this is the position that Trump is in. His very presidency might depend on him acquiescing to the. And in this sense, he does not have control of his own foreign and military policy, which are the primary purview and powers of the presidency.
That's the voice of Mark Sloboda. We're talking to Mark from Moscow. He is an international affairs and security analyst. We're also talking from the San Francisco Bay Area with Rick Sterling. Rick is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. We're talking about whether or not U.S. troops are going to be leaving Syria. Seems clearly in the last 24 hours that Trump is capitulating to the pressure. We don't know how it'll play out. There's lots of surprises within the Trump administration. But Rick Sterling, Mark Sloboda has touched upon an important point, which is what's loosely called or what we generally refer to as the neocons, neoconservatives. Now, when we think about the neocons, we think about the early years of the Bush administration. The Project for a New American Century was its principal think tank. You had Bush and Cheney, of course, as president and vice president, Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. Paul Wolfowitz, you had other, you know, significant figures who were promoting the idea that the U.S. should, in this new unipolar world, absent the Soviet Union, go in and basically crush any independent sovereign government that they targeted if those governments more or less emanated from the anti-colonial project of the post-World War II era that had survived and were part of a diplomatic and military alliance with the former Soviet Union and socialist bloc countries, that these countries like Syria, like Iraq, like Libya, like Zimbabwe, Cuba, they should all be overthrown. Now, today, that it's not like a wing of the U.S. foreign policy establishment. It seems to be the consensus position in the U.S. foreign policy establishment. How did it get there?
That's a big question. They set out very specific goals in 2000 when the Project for a New American Century, you know, was at kind of the peak of its power. They produced a document, and the interesting element is that they set very specific goals regarding the defense budget, regarding privatizing the military, fighting multiple wars simultaneously, and a host of other specific goals. And the somewhat shocking thing is that they have actually accomplished a lot of those goals. And so at an economic level and also at the level of policy in the United States, a lot of those goals have actually been carried out, and it's taken us to where we're at, where it's turning out not to be the American century, but the American nightmare, where we're fighting at least seven military conflicts right now, where we're spending, you know, approaching $2 billion a day that we don't have. The deficit is skyrocketing, so on and so forth. But going back to the current situation, that's kind of at the broad level. But I always find it interesting to look at the New York Times readers' comments, which reflect the views of the people who read the New York Times. It's a lot of well-educated people. One could say, you know, liberal people or elite people. But there was an interesting comment. The best comment I saw today, which was very much in contrast with the general opposition to withdrawing troops from Syria that readers reflected. There was a veteran, a U.S. military veteran, commented, and it just takes a, there's a few sentences here. I think he really, I think this reader really nailed it. He said, after three deployments to this area, that being the Middle East, I can say that our involvement is worthless and only makes the overall situation worse. Trump, unfortunately, had the right instinct, but he's afraid. I think the rabid opposition by the New York Times, among others, to his withdrawal from Syria and potentially Afghanistan made him walk it back. Obviously, Israel revels in the conflict because it takes the heat off them as they continue to colonize the West Bank. The problem is Trump is not well-read, not well-educated, and he is, as a consequence, not self-confident. Were he better educated, he would fire Bolton, get out of Syria and Afghanistan, and demand that Israel get out of the West Bank. Our nation is being led by Riyadh and Jerusalem. If Trump does not get us out of Syria and Afghanistan, he can forget winning in 2020. So that's the analysis and the viewpoint of a military veteran, and I think it's overall a good analysis, and I think his prediction about 2020 is also prescient.
Mark Sloboda, we have about 2.5 minutes left. I was looking at James Mattis's resignation letter. He says, similarly, I believe we must be resolute and unambiguous in our approach to those countries whose strategic interests are increasingly in tension with ours. It is clear that China and Russia, for example, want to shape a world consistent with their authoritarian model, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, because you have a right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours on these and other subjects, he's resigning. It seemed to me that that might be part of what's happening is that the U.S. politics, the politicians are supposed to faithfully execute the consensus position. And Trump isn't unambiguous. He's ambiguous because you might not know, will he go into a room with Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un and make an agreement because he wants a deal, or talk to Erdogan and say, yeah, we want to get the troops out of Syria. And as a consequence, the military, which Trump, knowing that he was under attack, tried to immunize himself or inoculate himself by having a cabinet full of generals. When he made this decision, the generals have turned against him. We have 1 minute left. Go ahead.
Yeah, when Mattis says that, you know, that Russia and China want to extend their authoritarian model, what they really mean is that Russia and China are exercising independence and sovereignty as rising great powers in a multipolar world, and are starting to push back in a matter of spectrums against, you know, what has become an extremely aggressive and overbearing and overstretched the U.S. global military hegemony. And Trump is not consumed with that foreign policy perspective, which amounts to a quite fundamentalist, exceptionalist ideology. Trump naturally gravitates to some of the people like Kissinger who have advised him in the past towards a realist, transactional approach to foreign policy, and he would like to believe that he can sit down with anyone in a room without any type of belief in the innate moral superiority of his society over theirs and come away with a compromise, with a deal. And I think that that is something that the majority of the U.S. blob, deep state, foreign policy establishment has lost the ability to do, because basically they started to believe their own exceptionalist mythology.
We're going to leave it right there. That was Mark Sloboda. Mark is an international affairs and security analyst. We were talking to him from Moscow. We were also joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. Rick is an investigative journalist and a member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Chris, since we spend so much time on the issue of privacy, let's start there again. There was some news this week about a lawsuit. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this actually came out at the end of 2018, but you know, with the holidays, many people missed it, and I wanted to bring it up again. The ACLU is suing the U.S. government to learn more details about the NSA's call records program. So this is a lawsuit against the National Security Agency, the Director of National Intelligence, the CIA, and the Justice Department. It was filed in Manhattan Federal Court about a week ago. And what they're asking for here is information on the follow-up to the 2015 USA Freedom Act. If folks don't remember, the USA Freedom Act was intended, part of it, to curb the NSA's spying powers by just giving more power to the telecommunications companies, saying that the telecommunications companies had to hold the data that they were previously giving the NSA, and that the government could then ask the telecommunications companies for certain records. It didn't seem all that much better to me to have the private companies holding these records for the government rather than the government holding them. Seems kind of 6-1 to me. But there were also supposed to be transparency reports coming out of this. And the ACLU is asking the government for more details than are in these transparency reports, because it doesn't seem like the reports are actually reflecting the real situation and what the NSA continues to do. And just as a reminder for the listeners, what the NSA does is look at all of the internet and phone traffic. You know, they say just anything coming from outside the U.S. in or in the U.S. out, but that very much often sweeps up domestic traffic, internet or phone traffic in those sweeps. We've talked about it a couple weeks ago in the case of Aaron Swartz, and it happens very, very often. And it is a domestic spying program, whether it's been, you know, tamped back or not legally. It does continue, and it is domestic spying.
You know, one of the most interesting things that I got out of this lawsuit, it says here, the government said it collected over 534 million call detail records in 2017. 534 million records, even though it reported having only 40 surveillance targets. That's dragnet collection. That ought to be illegal. I believe it's unconstitutional.
No, it is. There is that thing called the Fourth Amendment.
Exactly.
The government can't search and seize your stuff, including your communications, simply because in these concentric circles, somehow you've talked to somebody who talked to somebody who talked to somebody who talked to somebody who talked to the target. And that's actually what's going on, right?
Oh, yeah. That's what it is. Is it not? Isn't it these second, third, and fourth degrees of separation, Chris?
Yes, that is one of the ways that they get this, is if there's an international target, but then there are connections made on the inside the U.S., they can use that as an excuse. But yeah, John, I'm glad you pointed that out. 534 million call detail records for 40 surveillance targets. There's no good explanation for that other than just being a massive spy state apparatus. There can't be a good explanation for that.
And, you know, remember, John, we've talked to Bill Binney, famous legendary right. NSA whistleblower, former technical director of the NSA. He's making the point that when you collect that much information, what is it?
34 million.
34 million records. The haystack is so big that you actually can't focus on the needle. And so as a consequence, not only does it violate everyone's constitutional rights, because that data is collected and it's stored, it's retained, it's always there for the government to go and pick through if they want to try to make a prosecution against somebody. They can do a parallel construction after the fact, you know, to sort of hide how they got the information. But they can't really zero in as effectively on the real target. So not only is it, this is Binney's point, a violation of the First and Fourth Amendment, it's also not efficacious. It's not effective from a law enforcement point of view. And as a consequence, he draws the conclusion that if it doesn't work, not really, if it's better to have like a narrowed target for law enforcement purposes, if it doesn't work and it collects all this data, the real reason that we have this kind of mass surveillance is people are making money from it and they're getting contracts from it. And it's, in other words, his argument is that this is actually a form of corruption. Anyway, do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with that. And we know that companies, for example, AT&T, partner very closely with the surveillance state agencies. They have, the NSA has rooms in more than half a dozen AT&T facilities across the country, where they can tap directly into their communication systems in these interchanges, where so much phone and internet traffic is spread across not just the country, but the world. And AT&T doesn't do that for free. They're not doing that because they are patriotic companies, or, you know, because they feel like nice people. They're doing that because they're getting money for it.
And again, we have to go back and remind our listeners who might be listening to Chris, and we talk to Chris every Monday. At the end of this segment, he'll give us a technology tip. But one of the things that Chris Garaffa has told us over and over again, and anybody who's involved in political activism should be told this over and over again by whatever group you're in: don't make jokes.
Mm-mm.
Don't make off-color jokes. Don't make threatening comments that are in jest about anybody. Don't talk about illegal activity even in jest, because people horse around. They make jokes. And as a consequence, they don't realize that if the government is having this kind of mass data collection, nobody can compute or determine from the transcript of a phone call whether you made a joke or not.
In fact, Eliot Spitzer, the former governor of New York, said something that is exactly on point here one time. He said, "Never talk when you can nod, never nod when you can wink, and never, ever put anything in an email because it's death." And he's right. If you make a joke in an email, and the next thing you know, some special counsel or special investigator has your emails and he takes them out of context, you're dead.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
I think we're seeing a very light version almost of this, or something related to this. You know, a decade and a half ago, many of us were talking about the first online presidential campaign, or the first presidential campaign that would be, you know, rocked by something that the candidate posted on a blog in 2003. And, you know, we're not quite there yet, but we're seeing, you know, this video of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez dancing, right? Which, you know, is not damning at all.
No, it's very cute.
Yeah, it's cute. More people are actually liking her now than before. But, you know, this was some random YouTube video from 2010 that has since come out. So this is just to Brian's point, too, to expand on that nothing is ever removed from the internet. You know, you can delete it, but somebody's got it in a copy somewhere, and it's not going to disappear either. So I just want to add that to Brian's comment.
Yeah, so it's the government that you worry about, but also all the trolling that goes. I mean, the internet is its own little bubble world. People who have almost no influence necessarily in real life can have an exaggerated sort of influence because they can occupy a lot of space on the internet. People don't really have the criteria to know whether something is actually important or whether something's authentic. We're going to talk, by the way, Chris, in another segment today about another false flag operation in Alabama, like the New Knowledge false flag operation, where they tried, these Democratic Party operatives in Alabama trying to help Doug Jones win the election, the special election for the U.S. Senate race. They made it appear, because they created fake websites and fake Facebook posts, and they employed Russian or Russian-seeming bots for Roy Moore, and then released to the media that Roy Moore was also a stooge of the Russians. It was all like a covert operation. There's another revelation that people created fake news Facebook posts because they said they were for prohibition, a dry Alabama. We're going to talk about this in another segment. A dry Alabama. And they were supporters of Roy Moore, and Roy Moore was going to support this. And so what they were trying to do was target conservative Republicans, but Republicans, say, who had businesses. And if Alabama went dry, if it couldn't sell liquor, if it couldn't have liquor licenses, those business people would be harmed. And they tried to affix that prohibition label to Roy Moore with the idea that some of these Republicans would either vote for Doug Jones or maybe they just wouldn't come to the polls. There's lots of ability to manipulate online. And again, you know, people sort of instantaneously, and this happens on Facebook all the time, you see something in your newsfeed and you think, wow, that's amazing. And you share it with your friends, and then they know you and they think you're authentic and you're credible. So you've shared it. So they share it. And as a consequence, not only are we vulnerable to the government being able to interfere by collecting data, storing data, retaining data, or retaining data on comments that we said without really meaning them. But there can be other actors who mean to do people harm who are creating false news.
That's right. And I'm glad you brought that up. I also saw that story in the New York Times this morning, just on a kind of a side note. Very interesting that the New York Times didn't put Russia anywhere in the headline in that one. It actually takes four or five paragraphs for them to mention Russia because it was, you know, the Democrats doing that. I thought that was very interesting in that story. But yeah, don't trust most of, you know, anything you see online unless you can verify it. Just like if you see something in print, consider the source. Who is it coming from? Who is the person or organization? We need to have the same common sense that we should use for all other sources.
Chris, I want to move on to another thing that you flagged for us. This is just so nutty, yet still so important. I'd like for our listeners to know about it. Facebook knows now how to track you using the dust on your camera lens. How is that?
So this is a very interesting story. I don't like the title of this story from Gizmodo, but it's a very interesting article. Facebook filed a patent application for that technology. And as we often talk about, patents are not proven technology. They're just somebody's idea. And the entire intellectual property system in the United States is completely broken that you can patent, you know, just this idea that you haven't even implemented, or that whole thing is a mess. But when we're looking at this patent, they say, okay, so if you have dust on your camera lens and you upload it to Facebook or Instagram, and then you send the photo to your friend and they upload it to Facebook or Instagram, they can actually just track the dust that was on your camera lens to see if you're uploading, you know, a similar photo or the same photo, even if they've edited the photo or cropped it or anything like that. These are the kind of things that Facebook is planning or looking at. But What I wanted to point out in this article is that Facebook says they don't use location for that, you know, that people you may know feature where it shows you like three or four people and says, do you want to add these people as friends? And Facebook constantly claims they don't use location for that. But there needs to be study done on this because, you know, just anecdotally for myself, but also for many people on both Facebook and Twitter and that talk in the security community, there are people that we've been in a room with and had no other contact with that Facebook then recommends. These people are not in our phone books. They are not anywhere in, you know, in the rest of our lives. But Facebook recommends them because we've been in a room together once or twice. And so people need to be cautious, actually, about this. People have had their therapists recommended to them on Facebook, meaning Facebook knows who your therapist is, which could be an issue of, you know, for some people trying to keep their information private, keep their medical issues private.
Chris, along these same lines, there's something that's so troubling in this article. I've got to raise it. It says here, in 2014, Facebook filed a patent application for a technique that employs smartphone data to figure out if two people might know each other, what you just said, where they suggest, you know, you may know John Smith over here. The author, an engineering manager at Facebook named Ben Chen, wrote that it was not merely possible to detect that two smartphones were in the same place at the same time, but that by comparing the accelerometer and the gyroscope readings of each phone, the data could identify when people were facing each other or walking together. And that way, Facebook could suggest that you friend the person you were talking to at a bar last night and not the other people that you chose not to talk to. That makes me want to throw my phone away.
It really does. It really does. You know, some people look at this and say, well, that would be an improvement if it wasn't some random person at the bar, but actually the person I was talking to. But it's still very scary. But yeah, this would be two steps, right? They figure out, first of all, where you are. And they can do that even if you've turned your location services off.
Right.
They can still do that based on your IP address that your phone or computer always has. It has to for the way the internet works. That can give away your general or sometimes specific location. And then, yeah, they can get information about how you're holding your phone. And we've talked in the past about how advertisers are actually using that to identify people. Do you hold your phone at a certain angle regularly? Do you use it on your table, you know, flat? How quickly do you pick it up? So Facebook could use all of that information as well as a second way to corroborate, you know, these connections.
Wow. It's mind-blowing.
Chilling.
We talk about these issues all the time, but I'm going to keep reading from the same article, John, that you just read from. In the course of our year-long investigation into how the social network makes its uncannily accurate friend recommendations to users, Facebook has told us many things it doesn't do. to ease fears about Facebook's ability to spy on its users. It doesn't use proxies for locations such as Wi-Fi networks or IP addresses. It doesn't use profile views or face recognition or who you text with on WhatsApp. Most of Facebook's uncanny guesswork is the result of a healthy percentage of users simply handing over their address books.
Frankly, I don't believe that. I flat out just don't believe that based on my experience. And again, the experiences many, many people have shared. There need to be studies done on this. There needs to be scientific studies done on this, on the algorithm they use. But I've had people, I know myself and many others I know, have had people who upload, who have never given Facebook their address books because we realized what a bad idea that was, who still get these recommendations that could really only be based on location, you know, or very other circumstantial situations. I don't, and you know, it's not like Facebook hasn't lied to us in the past about what they're doing with our information. Again, there need to be scientific studies done on this, but I think we need to be very, very cautious about believing Facebook when they say what it does or doesn't use to recommend connections. And I think that a concern we need to consider here too, in the context of what we were talking about earlier regarding organizers and activists, is what if Facebook gets a subpoena to say, hey, not just who are this person's friends, but who have they been around? Who might they know? Because we know that Facebook obviously gives us a network of who we know, a social graph, so to say. But now they could also be giving law enforcement a graph of people we might know. And law enforcement will use that to create cases against people, even if they are completely bogus.
Yeah, this is an amazing story. Facebook says it doesn't use these things, doesn't use IP addresses, it doesn't use profile views or face recognition.
Location address.
But then it goes on, the article goes on, but that doesn't mean Facebook hasn't thought about employing users' metadata more strategically to make connections between them. We're pondering it. We're just not sure yet. This is Facebook thinking. Patents filed by Facebook that mention people you may know show some ingenious methods that Facebook is devised for figuring out the seeming strangers on the network might know each other. One filed in 2015 describes a technique that would connect two people through the camera metadata associated with the photos they uploaded. It might assume two people knew each other if the images they uploaded looked like they were titled in the same series of photos, then they give the titles. For example, or if lens scratches or dust were detectable in the same spots on the same photos, revealing the photos were taken by the same camera. I'm not talking, Chris, because I'm a bit speechless. Go ahead. You get the final word, then we're going to move to the next story.
You know, it's just, I was kind of speechless too, Brian, when I read this. It's, you know, the things that are in the back of our heads, but this is really putting it all into one article. We need to just, you know, always think Facebook is five steps ahead of what most of us would even think they would be doing with our information. And we should be aware of, you know, do we even want to have this app on our phone next to, do we even want to use it?
Okay. I'm taking the Facebook app off my phone right now. Let's move on with the next story.
So the next one is about NPR podcasts, like the way many people might be listening to this show if they're not in the Washington, D.C. area. Podcasts are very popular. They've really gained in reach in the last, especially the last five to 6 years. But NPR, which does host a number of podcasts for its shows, wants to start getting giving advertisers more information about you based on how you listen to podcasts. So far, podcasting has been one of those ways, or one of the few areas that you can't really get specific analytics or data out of. All you could really track was how many people downloaded this podcast. And in some instances, you could see how many people started to play it, but you couldn't see, you know, did they listen to an ad? What ads did they skip? Or what segments in the show did they skip? Or what did people go back and listen to? Which, you know, advertisers would be very, very interested in. Think about how Netflix tracks everything we do, where we pause, what scenes we rewind, what we start to watch and never finish, and all that. So NPR, of all organizations, wants to start monetizing its podcasts even more and give more information about our listening habits to advertisers. So not just, you know, that's putting it into the hands of private companies, what we listen to, where we listen, how we listen, what we're interested in, but it's also opening it up as a huge security risk. We talk all the time about breaches and security, you know, and security and leaks because of poor security. So this information, which could then be correlated to other stuff, you know, that we do on our phones or our computers, what websites we're visiting, all of that, could then just, you know, all add up to creating bigger and bigger data profiles on us that we don't even know about and we're not in control of.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We talk to Chris every Monday about the big issues in the world of technology. This segment is called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa. Chris, we have about 7.5 minutes left. What's our next story?
Okay, this next one, also very scary. DNA, you know, home DNA testing has become a really big industry in the last few years. You know, that you get these kits, they get sent to you, or you can even pick them up at a drugstore, and you put a little, you know, saliva on it, or you breathe on it, or however it works, and you send it back to some company, and they tell you, oh, you know, your ancestors may have come from these countries in Europe, or, you know, this place in the world, or that place in the world, and that's been a huge, you know, a huge industry, and for good reason. People want to know what their history is, where they come from, and also it can be used for medical testing. It can tell you that, you know, you may be more, if you have a certain gene, you may be more susceptible to heart disease, for example, and that's something you might want to talk to your doctor about and you know, make a plan for, and that could be great. But now, DNA testing company 23andMe, which is one of the biggest ones,
yep,
is working with GlaxoSmithKline, which is a pharmaceutical company, and GSK has acquired a $300 million stake in 23andMe. So this isn't necessarily anything new, right? Ancestry.com, which does a similar has a similar DNA testing program, has also been working with these drug companies, but this is one of the largest deals that has ever been inked for $300 million between DNA testing companies and Ancestry. Now, the entire health insurance industry is getting more and more data driven, and the entire healthcare industry along with that. But we know healthcare is driven by the insurance industries. You know, we can't get healthcare, we get health insurance, right? And so all of this is really scary in terms of what these companies are going to do together with our information. We have talked, you know, we've seen in the past ideas and proposals from companies about potentially targeting individuals with pills, which in theory could be a really fantastic medical breakthrough. But when it's done for profit, that's only going to be available to the ultra wealthy. It's not going to be available to you and me.
You know, it seems to me that there is a sinister side to this, too. I'm a big supporter of 23andMe. I take all the tests and participate in the research and email DNA cousins and all that stuff. But when a giant pharmaceutical company steps in and buys such a gigantic stake in the company, I have a feeling, Chris, that it's not because of a low PE ratio and, you know, a long-term investment. It's got to be something more sinister.
I think, I mean, the drive for profits, John, I think always makes things even more sinister than they potentially are on the surface. And we should also not forget, you know, this can be used by law enforcement as well.
And has been, actually.
And has been. They caught the example that's always given. They caught the Golden State Killer.
That's right.
Not by even his own DNA, but because his brother's was in a database.
Yep, that's absolutely right. Well, let's go on to the next one. What else is happening?
You know, I actually did not know this. The Weather Channel app, you know, kind of the de facto, you know, best weather app.
Which we all have.
Well, I don't anymore. I switched over to Weather Underground a while back just because it was better for my area. But IBM actually owns that. That application. The Weather Channel does not own its own app through a complicated series of business transactions. Now, but there's a lawsuit against IBM over the Weather Channel app, sending your precise location to advertisers and third-party trackers, even though it just tells people that your location data is going to be used just for, you know, figuring out where you are and telling you what the weather is going to be. So this is a lawsuit filed last week in California against IBM, which California certainly does want to have some of the best privacy laws. And I'm looking forward to watching this lawsuit go forward this year to see how the courts stand up against this. It was because, again, it's the app says we're going to use your location to tell you the weather where you are. You kind of have to give a weather app your location. But it turns out that it was sending all this to advertising and tracking companies as well.
You can't trust anybody, not even the Weather Channel. This is a good one, Chris. Gmail tracking your purchases if you get a receipt sent to your Gmail account. Best Buy does this. Home Depot does this. I always decline the electronic receipt.
And this is something that I discovered. It wasn't apparently a secret, but I wanted to point it out to people. If you go to google.com/purchases, you get a list of everything you've bought that where you've had a receipt sent to your Gmail account. They keep track of all of that. I bought something on Amazon, and within a minute, the receipt was in my inbox, and there it was in this list. Now, Gmail, Google, of course, does have access to your email. It stores your email, but it's explicitly making this list to create additional information in your profile for advertising of what you've purchased, but not what you've purchased through Google, what you've purchased through Amazon and other companies as well. I have concert tickets in here that I've seen in my list, local coffee shops. So it's just, it's nothing, apparently nothing secret or nothing new, but not well publicized that Google is doing this. And that's why I wanted to raise it.
Chris Garaffa is our guest. We're talking about technology issues as we do with Chris Garaffa every Monday. Chris, we have 75 seconds left. What's the technology tip for the week?
Well, the technology tip is to actually just kind of help people not look foolish on Facebook this week. There's a, and this is a years old hoax that's been going around where people are told to post in response to new Facebook guidelines. I hereby declare my copyright is attached to all my personal details and so on and so forth. And people post this legal-looking paragraph on their walls and think it's going to affect how Facebook does or does not use their data. Please don't post that. If you're on my friends list and I see you posting this, I'm gonna call you out on it. This has no effect. Posting something on Facebook is like putting up a sticky note on your front door saying "cops don't come in." It's not. It doesn't actually change anything. This thing cites the Berne Convention and also the Rome Statute, which actually has nothing to do with copyright law at all. We should be concerned about how Facebook is using our data, but posting something on your wall is not going to stop Facebook from abusing our information.
Yeah, and Messenger is not going to donate 45 cents every time you forward the picture of the kid laying in the hospital bed.
No, it's not, and neither is Bill Gates. So let's get that one out of the way, too.
We'll leave it there. We were very happy to be joined by Chris Garaffa. He is a web developer and technologist who joined us from New Haven, Connecticut. Chris joins us every Monday for a half-hour segment called Technology Rules. It's always interesting, and it's always important, so tune in again next week. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break, and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.